Now, our last lady from Alaska was named Eleanor William, and she was born in College Station, Texas in 1937. And in 1963, she, her husband, and seven children moved to Anchorage. And she worked for 5 years as a stenographer, but she had her eye on the skies because she wanted to do something more. And in 1968, the qualifications to be an air controller changed. You no longer had to have been a pilot or had to have had military experience. You just had to get trained. And she did that. She went to the schools, was trained, or the training, whatever the, wherever they train air traffic controllers. In 1971, she was certified as an air traffic control specialist. And she worked at Anchorage Airport and moved from specialist to supervisor to another level to management and left in 1993. In 1994, she went to Oberlin, Ohio, and she was the first Black female manager of the Cleveland Air Traffic Control, which was at that time one of the most busy air traffic facilities. 3 years later, she was promoted to executive management for the FAA regional office in Chicago. That job was either so good or so hard that she retired in 1997, but she kept a home in Anchorage and one in Texas until she died in 2011. Now, she was active in the community and in getting women and Black people to become pilots. And in a speech she gave celebrating Martin Luther King Jr. in 1996, she said, "Be an agent of change, not a victim of change. It's easy to say it's not my problem, but I pledge to make a positive difference every day of my life for the rest of my life. I challenge you to make the same pledge." So those are some of the women who have, some of the Black women who overcame, didn't even pay any attention to the discrimination and segregation and prejudice of the times that they came up in and made their way here to Alaska. And Alaska has, is history's different in terms of racial things because there have been so few Black people here. And there's a lot of problems, of course, and discrimination and problems and struggles with the Native people here. But there were in the cities, and well, particularly in Anchorage, there was some civil rights activity done around a shopping center. I think it was Cars, because they weren't hiring or promoting Black people, and that seemed to make some changes. But I don't know if it, everyone knows, but Anchorage has some of the most diverse communities and most diverse schools in the nation. So it's an interesting town, and there's also a significant population of Black people in Fairbanks and younger Black people who've gotten together and formed an artist organization. And in Homer, well, you all know that story. Now, we're going to go. Now, the book is free. This is the book. I will send the information on how you can get it. It is from the Department of Interior Park Service, and it's free. And so it's good reading, and you might enjoy it. Oh, there was one woman, another woman I knew who lived in Alaska, because she's in this book. Her name was Opalonga Pugh. I met Opalonga Pugh before I came to Alaska when she was a storyteller in Denver, Colorado. So she did some work here before she became a storyteller, and exactly how she became a storyteller from the work that she was doing here, I don't know that story. What's interesting and strange though, is that it was, I met her and another Black storyteller in Denver named Marjorie Hunn. And sadly, And oddly, and Marjorie was much younger than me, but both of these ladies passed. Opalanga was well known in among national storytellers group. She had cancer, but I didn't know what happened with Marjorie. I just found out one time she had passed. So it was strange, but Opalanga Pugh was a storyteller, but she worked in Alaska first. Now we've got a few more minutes, quite a few more minutes. I'm gonna tell a story that I just recently found out about. And this is, we're going now to the lower 48, to the 1960s. And in the early 1960s, 1962, 1963, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, known as SNCC, began to hold mass meetings to train youth and children in nonviolent protests and actions. And this decision was discussed and decided among several of the civil rights leaders, including Martin Luther King, because they recognized that there might be some danger, but they didn't think it could be as bad as it ended up being. So I think most of you are familiar with the scenes of the children getting sprayed with the water hoses and all of that from the early 60s. And that was actually a result of these efforts, because they were thinking, well, they're children, they won't be this cruel, but they were. But it was effective still. And the children, they were like the bird, the golden bird. And one of the stories, though, that, like I said, I hadn't gotten that much attention, is the story of the Leesburg Stockade Girls. And this was in July of 1963. And these girls, they'd been attending the trainings. And so they had decided that they were going to march from the Baptist church to the movie theater. And instead of forming a line to pay for their tickets in the alley, they went to the front of the movie theater to pay for their tickets. And next thing they know, there's police. They are getting herded into some kind of a truck. And it's 15 girls, aged 12 to 15. And they were never charged anything. Their parents didn't know for weeks where they were, because the girls were taken from their town of Americus, Mississippi, first to a town called Dawson, and then from Dawson, they were taken to this Leesburg Stockade, which is an old abandoned stockade. And when the girls got there, there was no bedding, there was nothing there. They were fed, but they had no bedding, minimal toilet facilities. And one lady said it was like the hole that it just drained all, actually took the water out of their bodies. These girls spent 45 days there. And finally, a member of SNCC, a young man who was a photographer, found out where the girls were, and he went and took a picture of them from a window. And that got put in Black newspapers across the country, and they were released. The sad thing about this story is that these girls who grew up into Black women never talked about the experience for 50 years. And when they talked about it, it was in 2015, because someone actually held a commemorative event. The Southwestern State University held a commemorative event of the Leesburg Stockade Girls. And they had been nominated for some award, which they didn't get, but it did provide them the opportunity to have someone videotape them They went, some of the women went back to the stockade and they cried. And they talked, you know, they talked about what it was like. And one of them said her mother had tried to talk to her about it, but the girl didn't want to talk about it. And they still haven't really gone through that whole process. And it was touching, but it was good too for some of them to finally be able to share the experience and talk about it to a certain degree to other people and even to themselves. But that's just an example of some of the trauma that people have gone through that they don't talk about. And it still affects people's day-to-day lives in ways they might not even know, because they've been afraid to deal with those feelings and those experiences. Are there any questions or discussion or comments? And Mr. Evans, did you know Mahala Dickerson? Can you unmute it? Can we unmute him, Claudia? I can't unmute you.
I just asked him to unmute, so he should be able to.
Okay. She said you should be able to now, Charles. Oh, we can't hear you, Charles. You have to unmute your computer. It should be at the bottom of your screen. Oh, it's okay. You figure you can come back.
Unmute. Yes, I knew Ashley Dickerson. I came to the state and was admitted to practice in 1977. I came in 1976 and clerked. And so I knew of Ashley Dickerson when I clerked for a Superior Court judge. And then when I started practicing law, I had a case with her. And it was the most wonderful experience. You know, I'm from Southern Virginia, you know, deep slave South. I mean, people don't really think of it that way, but was. And we had a good relationship and I always respected her and she had a sharp mind. And like you said, she was fearless.
So, that's great.
She represented the underdog almost always. But, and she was a respected member of the bar. And I think all the lawyers that I knew certainly loved her and respect her and welcomed her to practice and practiced, you know, collegial comity and, you know, dinners together, lunches and things like that. So, and she was a part of that community.
Thank you.
So thank you for raising her up. In fact, I told Nancy, I just got to listen tonight to hear you talk about Ashley Dickerson. Well, thank you so much, and thank you for your efforts. These are wonderful programs you do. Still telling you're doing, okay?
I'm glad you were here because I saw and being a lawyer.
I just want to add that I knew of her through her support of the Quakers.
Oh, right.
And they would go out and use her property for their annual meetings.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that's great. We don't get this except when you're doing stories with at home. See, this is a home time storytelling. But now we're going to go. Was there anybody else who had any comments about any of the Alaska women or the Leesburg girls or questions? Okay, so I'm going to go through Mary Seacole. Now, Mary Seacole was not from the United States. She was Jamaican. But this is Black history. We started in Africa and we've been through the States and we've been through Alaska. And Mary Seacole was born in 1805 in Kingston, Jamaica. In 1807, the African slave trade in British territories was abolished. And it's interesting when, as I'm going to tell her life story, how it was different in Jamaica from the United States. First of all, they stopped selling the slave trade real quick earlier. But by 1822, she's able to go and visit London on her own as a free Black woman. And she goes back in 1823, and in 1826, she's an adult. And by 1836, she's back in England and has married Horatio Hamilton Seacole, an Englishman. And they go back and live in Kingston. She loses her home. Her husband dies when she's 39. Now she is developing nursing skills throughout her life. And she takes care of people and she works and does nursing for people. She takes care of people and has helped people and helped people to get well. And in 1850, during the cholera outbreak, she left Kingston and went and joined her brother in Panama and opened a hotel. And somewhere she gets the idea, because of the war that was going on in Crimea, that she wants to go and help the soldiers in Crimea, because she's a nurse. She's been nursing, she's helped other people. And so she goes to see Florence Nightingale. And Florence Nightingale is downright rude. Doesn't even give her a chance, won't talk to her. And Mary doesn't just take being ignored once. She goes back a couple of times and is basically ignored and told, no, you can't help, more than once. So she says, okay. And what she does is she opens her own British hotel in the Crimea and takes care of wounded soldiers there. And people know and appreciate what she does. And she writes her autobiography in 1857. The thing, and the reason this story is significant to me, it's because I was a nurse. And Florence Nightingale did a lot of stuff. But Florence Nightingale was racist and prejudiced, because there was no reason she could not have accepted help from Mary Seacole. And Mary Seacole continued to live a great life, because obviously her husband, and I don't know, I forget her family, but she was well off, more well off than average Jamaicans going to England. And she did different businesses. And she tried to get into another war and was refused when she was 65. Then she tried to help for the Russian Franco-Prussian War. And she died when she was 76. And it says she died as a rich woman. But in her autobiography, she talks about how she was treated and how she kind of felt hurt at first, because Florence just blew her off. And then she realized she had her own resources to be able to help people. Now that's Mary Seacole. Now, one more lady from that time period of after the Civil War. And this lady is very interesting and she's very controversial. Her name is Lucy Parsons. Now, she was born in 1848 in slavery. And she's a very light-skinned, fair, beautiful woman. And she told people she was part Indian, she was different Latina. There's all kinds of stories about her past, which is understandable, because if you remember the stories I told last week about during slavery, the coming out looking very fair-skinned has a lot of ancestral history behind it, and some of it isn't pleasant at all in terms of during slavery and with things that, and also to be Black at that time, right after slavery, still wasn't a good thing or helpful thing. But what's interesting is that she ended up marrying, while she was living in the South, a white man named Albert Parsons. Albert Parsons had fought for the Confederacy as a soldier. And then somehow he became a radical Republican. And don't know if it happened while he was falling in love with Lucy or if it was political influences. I haven't read all enough to know about that. But they got married. And of course, they left the South. They moved to Chicago. And they got involved rapidly in the labor movement, the socialist movement, and the anarchist movement. And it's primarily from the anarchist perspective that both of them got in trouble, because they both were really intense people. But what they were also working for was for better working conditions and the ability to organize and for people who were really poor, for them to have better opportunities. And they had a demonstration in Chicago, and they were talking about, you know, their rights and things they wanted to help people with. And as the demonstration was breaking up, police came. And after the police arrived, there was an explosion and some police died. And that was called the Haymarket Riot. Well, in the Haymarket, there were 8 men who were accused of causing the bombing. But it really wasn't clear that it had been a peaceful event until the end, when the people were breaking out and the police came. So anyhow, her husband was executed as one of the Haymarket 8. But she continued to work and this was in 1886. See, this is even before a lot of our women had come to Alaska. This was in May 1886. And it was a strike for the 8-hour workday in Chicago. And for demonstrating and working for that, they were made criminals. And like I said, 4 of the men were executed. But she continued the work. And one of the things she did in 1915, she organized protests in Chicago with Chicago's Hull House and Jane Addams, with the Socialist Party and the American Federation of Labor. And she wrote a lot. She wrote a whole lot of, she did speeches, she wrote articles, but she died in a house fire in 1942. And it said that the police removed many of her papers that survived the fire. So a lot of her writings have disappeared. And a lot of people, well, not a lot, but some people have done books about her. And she has some of her writings. And I'm going to read a little bit from one of her writings. And this was printed in the Kansas City Journal, December 21st, 1886. And the title was, "I Am an Anarchist." I suppose you came here, the most of you, to see what a real live anarchist looked like. I suppose some of you expected to see me with a bomb in my hand and a flaming torch in the other, but are disappointed in seeing neither. If such has been your ideas regarding an anarchist, you deserved to be disappointed. Anarchists are peaceable, law-abiding people. What do anarchists mean when they speak of anarchy? Webster gives the term 2 definitions: chaos and the state of being without political rule. We cling to the latter definition. Our enemies hold that we believe only in the former. Do you wonder why there are anarchists in this country, in this great land of liberty, as you love to call it? Go to New York. Go through the byways and alleys of that great city. Count the myriad starving. Count the multiplied thousands who are homeless. Number those who work harder than slaves and live on less and have fewer comforts than the meanest slaves. So she was, had come out of slavery. And it's interesting, however, she got educated, but just reading that, she was a very good writer and a woman of strong convictions. And I think she would just, her story would just make such a great movie. I mean, you could make several movies out of her life. So we've got 5 minutes left. Are there any questions, comments, or observations from any of you illustrious people? Well, I thank you for all coming. Some of you for have been here from the beginning. And next week, it's all about me. I love to say that. Actually, it's going to be my personal Black history. You know, I've got 7 decades, so I've got some stories. I've met some people, and I've been very fortunate. My story is a little, is my experience is that of having been a military Air Force brat. And so that's given some little different experiences from, it's not an urban experience and it's not a rural experience. It was an experience of not really getting to know people well because we were always moving around. But it's been great seeing everybody here. And I hope you all will come back next week. And I will have actually a family folktale to open with next week. So until then, I will see you next week. And like for those who can, because a lot of you didn't come in right away, I will have a bibliography, which will be given, Claudia will be sending to everyone who's registered, that'll list all the names of the people I've told stories about and some of the books, but just so that people have things for reference and something to remember. Thank you again.
Good night, everyone. Thank you, Skywalker.
You're welcome.
That's Skywalker Payne, Tuesday night, telling part 3 of her series, Mothers of Black History, through the Homer Public Library. You can register for next week's session by going to the Homer Public Library's website, and Skywalker Payne's work and stories through social media, or by going to velvetvoice.net. And for a free download of Black History and the Last Frontier by Ian C. Hartman, go to the National Park Service's webpage and search Black History and the Last Frontier. You'll find a link on kbbi.org along with this recording. This has been The Coffee Table. I'm Kathleen Gustafson for Wednesday, February 17th, 2021. Thanks for listening, Kachemak Bay. This is KBBI Homer, AM 890.